Bring up the bodies. Disc 8.
To Monseigneur, then. He has Risley to take the record of the meeting. Anne's father brings his own folio, while Brother George brings only his delightful self. He is always a sight to see. George likes his clothes braided and tasseled, stippled and striped and slashed. Today he wears white velvet over red silk, scarlet rippling from each gash. He is reminded of a picture he saw once in the Low Countries, of a saint being flayed alive. The skin of the man's calves was folded neatly over his ankles, like soft boots, and his face wore an expression of unblinking serenity. He puts his papers down on the table. I will not waste words. You see the situation. Matters have come to the king's attention that, if he had always known them, would have prevented this pretensed marriage with Lady Anne. George says, I have spoken to the Earl of Northumberland. He stands by his oath. There was no pre-contract. Then that is unfortunate, he says. I do not see what I am to do. Perhaps you can help me, Lord Rochford, with some suggestions of your own.
We will help you to the Tower, says George.
Minute that, he says to Risley. My Lord Wiltshire, may I recall some circumstances that your son here may be unaware of? In the matter of your daughter and Harry Percy, the late Cardinal called you to account, warning you that there could be no match between them for the lowness of your family and the high estate of the Percy line. And your answer was that you were not responsible for what Anne did, that you could not control your own children. Thomas Boleyn arranges his face, as a certain piece of knowledge dawns.
So it was you, Cromwell, scribbling in the shadows.
I never denied it, my lord. Now, on that occasion, you did not get much sympathy from the Cardinal. Myself, being a father of a family, I understand how these things occur. You would hold to it at the time that your daughter and Harry Percy had gone far in the matter, but what you meant, as the Cardinal was pleased to put it, a haystack and a warm night. You implied their liaison was consummated, and a true marriage. Boleyn smirks.
But then the king made known his feelings for my daughter.
So you rethought your position, as one does. I'm asking you to rethink once more. It would be better for your daughter if she had, in fact, been married to Harry Percy. Then her marriage to the king could be proclaimed null, and the king would be left free to select another lady. A decade of self-aggrandizement since his daughter flashed her cunny at the king has made Boleyn rich and settled and confident. His era is drawing to a close, and he, Cromwell, sees him decide not to fight it. Women age. Men like variety. It's an old story, and even an anointed queen cannot escape it to write her own ending.
So, what about Anne?
Her father says. No particular tenderness attaches to the question. He says as Carew did. Convent?
I should expect a generous settlement, Boleyn says. For the family, I mean.
Wait, George says. My lord father, enter into no undertakings with this man. Enter into no discussion.
Wiltshire speaks coldly to his son.
Sir, calmly. Things are as they are. What if, Cromwell, she were to be left in possession of her estate as marchioness, and we, her family, remain in undisturbed possession of ours?
I think the king would prefer her to withdraw from the world. I am sure we could find some godly house, well governed, where her beliefs and views will be comfortable.
I am disgusted,
George says. He edges away from his father. He says, Minute, Lord Rochford's disgust. Risley's pen scratches.
But our land, Wiltshire says, our officers of state. I could continue to serve the king as Lord Privy Seal, surely. And my son here, his dignities and titles. Cromwell wants me out,
George shoots to his feet.
That's the plain truth. He has never ceased to interfere with what I do in defence of the realm. He is writing to Dover, he is writing to Sandwich. His men are swarming everywhere. My letters are redirected to him. My orders are countermanded by him.
Oh, sit down, Risley says. He laughs, as much at his own wearied impertinence as at George's face.
Or, of course, my lord, stand, if you please.
Now Rochford does not know which to do. All he can do is reinforce that he is standing by flouncing on the spot. He can pick up his hat. He can say,
"I pity you, Master Secretary. If you succeed in forcing out my sister, your new friends will make short work of you once she is gone, and if you do not succeed and she and the King are reconciled, then I shall make short work of you. So whichever way you turn, Cromwell, you have overreached yourself this time."
He says mildly, "I only sought this interview, my Lord Rochford, because you have influence with your sister. No man more. I am offering you your safety, in return for your kind help." The elder Boleyn closes his eyes.
"I'll talk to her. I'll talk to Anne."
"And talk to your son here, because I will talk to him no more." Wiltshire says,
"I marvel, George, that you do not see where this is tending."
"What?"
George says.
"What, what?"
He is still watching as his father tows him away. On the threshold, the elder Boleyn bows his head civilly.
"Master Secretary, Master Risley."
They watch them go out, father and son.
"That was interesting," Risley says. "And where is it tending, sir?"
He reshuffles his papers.
"I remember," Risley says, "a certain play at court after the cardinal came down. I remember Sexton, the jester, dressed in scarlet robes in the character of the cardinal, and how four devils bore him off to hell, each seizing an extremity, and they were masked. And I wondered, was George?"
"Right forepaw," he says.
"Ah," says Callmy Risley.
I went behind the screen at the back of the hall. I saw them pull off their hairy bodies and Lord Rochford take off his mask. "Why did you not follow me? You could have seen for yourself." Mr. Risley smiles.
"I did not care to go behind that scene. I feared you might confuse me with the players, and forever after I would be tainted in your mind."
He remembers it. An evening of feral stench, as the flower of chivalry became hunting dogs, baying for blood, the whole court hissing and jeering as the figure of the cardinal was dragged and bounced across the floor. Then a voice called out from the hall, "Shame on you!" He asks Risley, "That was not you who spoke?"
"No."
Callmy will not lie.
"I think perhaps it was Thomas Wyatt."
"I believe it was. I have thought about it these many years. Look, Callmy, I have to go and see the king. Shall we have a glass of wine first?" Mr. Risley on his feet, searching out a waiting boy. Light shines on the curve of a pewter jug. Gascon wine splashes into a cup. "I gave Francis Bryan an import license for this," he says. "Would be 3 months back. No palate, has he? I didn't know he'd be selling it back to the king's buttery." He goes to Henry, scattering guards, attendants, gentlemen. He is barely announced so that Henry looks up, startled, from his music book. "Thomas Boleyn sees his way. He is only anxious to retain his good name with your majesty. But I cannot get any cooperation from his son."
"Why not?"
"Because he's an idiot. I think he believes your majesty's mind can be changed." Henry is piqued.
"He ought to know me. George was a little lad of 10 when he first came to court. He ought to know me. I do not change my mind."
It's true, in the one way. Like a crab, the king goes sideways to his destination, but then he sinks his pincers in. It is Jane Seymour who is pinched.
"I tell you what I think about Rochford," Henry says. "He is, what, 32 now? But he is still called Wiltshire's son. He is still called the Queen's brother. He does not feel he has come into his own, and he has no heir to follow him, not so much as a daughter. I have done what I can for him. I have sent him abroad many a time to represent me. And that will cease, I suppose, because when he is no longer my brother, no one will take any notice of him. But he will not be a poor man. I may continue to favour him, though not if he is obstructive. So he should be warned. Must I speak to him myself?"
Henry looks irritated. He should not have to manage this. Cromwell is supposed to manage it for him. Ease out the Boleyns, ease in the Seymours. His business is more kingly, praying for the success of his enterprises, and writing songs for Jane. Leave it a day or two, sir, and I will interview him apart from his father. I think in Lord Wiltshire's presence he feels the need to strut and posture.
Yes, I'm not often wrong, Henry says. Vanity, that's all it is. Now listen.
He sings. The daisy delectable, the violet wan and blue, I am not variable.
You perceive it is an old song that I'm trying to rework. What pairs with blue, apart from new?
What else do you need? He thinks. He takes his leave. The galleries are lit by torches, from which figures melt away. The atmosphere at court this Friday evening in April reminds him of the public bathhouses they have in Rome. The air is thick, and the swimming figures of other men glide past you. Perhaps men you know, but you don't know them without their clothes. Your skin is hot, then cold, then hot again. The tiles are slippery beneath your feet. On each side of you are doors left ajar, just a few inches. And outside your line of sight, but very close to you, perversities are occurring. Unnatural conjugations of bodies, men and women, and men and men. You feel nauseous from the sticky heat and what you know of human nature, and you wonder why you have come. But you have been told that a man must go to the bathhouse at least once in his life, or he won't believe it when other people tell him what goes on.
The truth is, Mary Shelton says, I would have tried to see you, Master Secretary, even if you had not sent for me.
Her hand shakes. She takes a sip of wine, looks deeply into the bowl as if divining, then raises her eloquent eyes.
I pray I never pass another day like this one. Nan Cobham wants to see you, Marjorie Horseman, all the women of the bedchamber.
Have you something to tell me? Or is it that you just want to cry on my papers and make the ink run? She puts down the cup and gives him her hands. He is moved by the gesture. It is like a child showing you her hands are clean. Shall we try to disentangle it? He asks gently. All day from the Queen's rooms, shouting, slamming doors, running feet, hissed conversations in undertones.
I wish I were gone from the court, Shelton says. I wish myself in another place.
She slides her hands away.
I should be married. Is that too much, to be married and have some children while I am still young?
Now, do not be sorry for yourself. I thought you were marrying Harry Norris.
So did I.
I know that there was some falling out between you. But that would be a year ago now.
I suppose Lady Rochford told you. You should not listen, you know, she invents things. But yes, it was true. I quarrelled with Harry, or he quarrelled with me, and it was over young Weston coming to the Queen's rooms in and out of season, and Harry thought he was casting his fancy to me, and so thought I. But I did not encourage Weston, I swear.
He laughs. But Mary, you do encourage men. It is what you do. You cannot help it.
So Harry Norris said, I will give that puppy a kick in the ribs he will not forget. Though Harry is not that sort of man, to go around kicking puppies. And the Queen, my cousin, said, No kicking in my chamber, if you please. Harry said, By your royal favour, I will take him out to the courtyard and kick him, and...
She cannot help laugh, though shakily, miserably.
And Francis standing there all the time, though they were talking about him as if he were absent. So Francis said, Well, I should like to see you kick me, for at your great age, Norris, you will wobble over.
Mistress, he says, Can you make it short?
But they go on like this an hour or more, scrapping and digging and scratching around for favour. And my lady the Queen is never weary of it. She eggs them on. Then Weston, he said, Do not agitate yourself, gentle Norris, for I come not here for Mistress Shelton. I come for the sake of another, and you know who that is. And Anne said, No, tell me. I cannot guess. Is it Lady Worcester? Is it Lady Rochford? Come, tell us, Francis. Tell us who you love. And he said, Madam, it is yourself.
And what did the Queen say?
Oh, she defied him. She said, You must not say so, for my brother George will come and kick you too, for the honour of the Queen of England. And she was laughing. But then Harry Norris quarrelled with me about Weston, and Weston quarrelled with him about the Queen, and both of them quarrelled with William Brereton.
Brereton? What had he to do with it?
Well, he happened to come in.
She frowns.
I think it was then. Or it was some other time that he happened to come in. And the Queen said, "Now here is the man for me. Will is one who shoots his arrows straight." But she was tormenting them all. You cannot understand her. One moment she is reading out Master Tyndall's gospel. Next moment, she shrugs. She opens her lips and out slides the devil's tail.
So, then, by Shelton's account, a year passes. Harry Norris and Mistress Shelton are speaking again, and soon they have made it up, and Harry is creeping to her bed. And all is as before. Until today, the 29th of April.
"This morning it began with Mark," Mary Shelton says. "You know how he hovers. He is always outside the Queen's presence chamber, and as she goes by, she does not speak to him, but laughs and tugs his sleeve or knocks his elbow, and once she snapped off the feather in his cap."
"I never heard of this as love play," he says. "Is it something they do in France?"
"And this morning," she says, "Oh, look at this little doggy," and she tousled him and pulled his ears, and his silly eyes brimming. Then she said to him, "Why are you so sad, Mark? You have no business to be sad. You are here to entertain us." And he offered to kneel down, saying, "Madam," and she cut him off. She said to him, "Oh, for Mary's sweet sake, stand on your 2 feet. I do you favours in noticing you at all. What do you expect? Do you think I should talk to you as if you were a gentleman? I cannot, Mark, because you are an inferior person." He said, "No, no, madam, I do not expect a word. A look suffices for me." So she waited, because she expected him to praise the power of her glance, that her eyes are lodestones, and so on. But he did not. He just burst into tears, and, "Farewell," he said, and walked away. Just turned his back on her. And she laughed. And so we went into her chamber.
"Take your time," he says.
Anne said, "Does he think I am some item from Paris Garden? That is, you know..."
"I know what Paris Garden is."
She blushes. "Of course you do. And Lady Rochford said it were well if Mark were dropped from a height like your dog Purkoy." And the Queen burst into tears. Then she struck Lady Rochford. And Lady Rochford said, "Do that again and I will buffet you back. You are no queen but a mere knight's daughter. Master Secretary Cromwell has your measure. Your day is over, madam."
He says, "Lady Rochford is getting ahead of herself."
Then Harry Norris came in.
"I was wondering where he was."
He said, "What is this commotion?" Anne said, "Do me a good turn. Take away my brother's wife and drown her. Then he can have a fresh one who may do him some good." And Harry Norris was amazed. Anne said to him, "Did you not swear you would do anything I wanted? That you would walk barefoot to China for me?" And Harry said, "You know he is droll." He said, "I think it was barefoot to Walsingham I offered." "Yes," she said, "and repent your sins there, because you look for dead men's shoes. If aught came to the king but good, you would look to have me."
He wants to write down what Shelton says, but he dare not move in case she stops saying it.
Then the Queen turned to me and said, "Mistress Shelton, you perceive now why he does not marry you. He is in love with me. So he claims and has claimed this long while, but he will not prove it by putting Lady Rochford in a sack and carrying her to the riverbank, which I much desire." Then Lady Rochford ran out.
"I think I understand why."
Mary looks up. "I know you are laughing at us, but it was horrible. For me it was, because I thought that it was a jest between them that Harry Norris loved her, and then I saw it was not. I swear he had turned pale, and he said to Anne, 'Will you spill all your secrets or only some?' And he walked away, and he did not even bow to her, and she ran after him. And I do not know what she said, because we were all frozen like statues."
Spill her secrets, all or only some. Who heard this?
She shakes her head. "Perhaps a dozen people. They could not help but hear it."
And then it appears the Queen was frantic.
"She looked at us, ranged about her, and she wanted to get Norris back. She said a priest must be fetched. She said Harry must take an oath that he knew her to be chaste, a faithful good wife. She said he must take back everything said, and she would take it back too, and they would put their hands on the Bible in her chamber, and then everybody would know that it was idle talk. She is terrified Lady Rochford will go to the king."
"I know Jane Rochford likes to carry bad news, but not such bad news as that. Not to a husband. That his dear friend and his wife have discussed his death, with a view to how they will console themselves after. It is treason, possibly, to envisage the death of the king. The law recognizes it. How short the step from dreaming to desiring to encompassing. We call it imagining his death. The thought is father to the deed, and the deed is born raw, ugly, premature. Mary Shelton does not know what she has witnessed. She thinks it is a lover's quarrel. She thinks it is one incident in her own long career of love and love's misfortunes.
"I doubt," she says dully, "that Harry Norris will marry me now, or even trouble himself pretending he is going to marry me. If you had asked me last week, 'Has the Queen given way to him?' I would have told you no. But when I look at them now, it is clear such words have passed between them, such looks, and how can I know what deeds? I think, I don't know what to think."
"I'll marry you, Mary," he says. She laughs, in spite of herself.
"Master Secretary, you will not. You are always saying you will marry this lady and that, but we know you hold yourself a great prize."
"Ah, well. So it's back to Paris Garden." He shrugs. He smiles. But he feels the need to be brisk with her, to hurry on. "Now, understand me. You must be discreet and silent. The thing you must do here, you and the other ladies, you must protect yourselves."
Mary is struggling. "It could not tend to bad, could it? If the king hears, he will know how to take it, yes? He may suppose it is all light words, no harm. It is all conjecture. Perhaps I have spoken in haste. One cannot know that anything has passed between them. I could not swear it."
He thinks, "But you will swear it. By and by you will."
"You see, Anne is my cousin."
The girl's voice falters.
"She has done everything for me."
"Even pushed you into the king's bed," he thinks, "when she was carrying a child, to keep Henry in the family."
"What will happen to her?"
Mary's eyes are solemn.
"Will he leave her? There is talk, but Anne does not believe it."
"She must stretch her credulity a little."
"She says, I can always get him back. I know how. And you know she always has. But whatever has happened with Harry Norris, I will not continue with her, for I know she would take him from me in no scruple if she has not already. And gentlewomen cannot be on such terms. Lady Rochford cannot continue, and Jane Seymour is removed for, well, I will not say why, and Lady Worcester must go home for her lying in this summer."
He sees the young woman's eyes move, calculating, counting. To her, a problem is looming, a problem of staffing Anne's privy chamber.
"But I suppose England has enough ladies," she says. "It were well she began again. Yes, a new beginning. Lady Lille in Calais looks to send her daughters over, I mean her daughters from her first husband. They are pretty girls, and I think they will do well when they are trained."
It is as if Anne Boleyn has entranced them, men and women both, so that they cannot see what is happening around them, and cannot hear the meaning of their own words. They have lived in stupidity such a long season.
"So do you write to Honor Lille?" Mary says, with perfect confidence. "She will be forever your debtor if she gets her girls at court."
"And you? What will you do?"
"I'll take thought," she says.
She is never put down for long. That's why men like her. There will be other times, other men, other manners. She hops to her feet. She plants a kiss on his cheek. It is Saturday evening. Sunday. "I wish you had been here this morning," Lady Rochford says with relish.
"It was something to witness. The king and Anne in the great window together, so everybody in the courtyard below could see them. The king has heard about the quarrel she had with Norris yesterday. Well, the whole of England has heard of it. You could see the king was beside himself. His face was purple. She stood with her hands clasped at her breast."
She shows him, clasping her own hands.
"You know, like Queen Esther in the king's great tapestry."
He can picture it easily, that richly textured scene, woven courtiers gathered about their distressed queen. One maid, as if unconcerned, carries a lute, perhaps en route to Esther's apartments. Others gossip aside, the women's smooth faces up-tilted, the men's heads inclined. Among these courtiers, with their jewels and elaborate hats, he has looked in vain for his own face. Perhaps he is somewhere else, plotting, a snapped skein, a broken end, an intractable knot of threads. Like Esther, he says. Yes.
Anne must have sent for the little princess, Lady Rochford says, because then a nurse heaved up with her, and Anne snatched her and held her up as if to say, "Husband, how can you doubt this is your daughter?"
You are supposing that was his question. You could not hear what was said.
His voice is cold. He hears it himself. Its coldness surprises him. Not from where I stood, but I doubt it bodes any good to her.
Did you not go to her, to comfort her, she being your mistress?
No, I went looking for you.
She checks herself, her tone suddenly sobered.
We, her women, we want to speak out and save ourselves. We are afraid she is not honest, and that we will be blamed for concealing it.
In the summer, he says, not last summer, but the one before, you said to me that you believed the Queen was desperate to get a child, and was afraid the King could not give her one. You said he could not satisfy the Queen. Will you repeat it now?
I'm surprised you don't have a note of our talk.
It was a long talk, and, with respect to you, my lady, more full of hints than particulars. I want to know what you would stand to if you were to be put on oath before a court.
Who is to be tried?
That is what I am hoping to determine, with your kind help. He hears these phrases flow out of him. With your kind help. Yourself not offended. Saving His Majesty.
You know it has come out about Norris and Weston, she says. How they have declared their love for her. They are not the only ones.
You do not take it as just a form of courtesy?
For courtesy, you do not sneak around in the dark. On and off barges, slipping through gates by torchlight, bribes to the porters. It has been happening these 2 years and more. You cannot know who you have seen, where and when. You would be sharp if you could catch any of them.
She pauses to be sure she has his attention.
Let us say the court is at Greenwich. You see a certain gentleman, one who waits on the king, and you suppose his tour of duty is over, and you imagine him to be in the country. But then you are about your own duties with the Queen, and you see him whisking around the corner. You think, why are you here? Norris, is that you? Many a time I have thought some one of them is at Westminster, and then I spy him at Richmond. Or he is supposed to be at Greenwich, and there he is at Hampton Court.
If they change their duties among themselves, it is no matter.
But I do not mean that. It is not the times, Master Secretary. It is the places. It is the Queen's gallery. It is her antechamber. It is her threshold, and sometimes the garden stair, or a little gate left unlocked by some inadvertence.
She leans forward, and her fingertips brush his hand as it lies on his papers.
I mean they come and go by night. And if anyone inquires why they should be there, they say they are a private message from the King. They cannot say to whom.
He nods. The Privy Chamber carry unwritten messages. It is one of their tasks. They come and go between the King and his peers, sometimes between the King and foreign ambassadors, and no doubt between the King and his wife. They do not brook questioning. They cannot be held to account. Lady Rochford sits back. She says softly,
"Before they were married, she used to practice with Henry in the French fashion. You know what I mean."
I have no idea what you mean. Were you ever in France yourself?
No. I thought you were.
As a soldier. Among the military, the ars amatoria is not refined. She considers this. A hardness creeps into her voice.
You wish to shame me out of saying what I must say. But I am no virgin girl. I see no reason not to speak. She induced Henry to put his seed otherwise than he should have. So now he berates her, that she caused him to do so.
Opportunities lost. I understand. Seed gone to waste, slid away in some crevice of her body or down her throat, when he could have been seeing to her in the honest English way.
He calls it a filthy proceeding, but God love him, Henry does not know where filth begins. My husband George is always with Anne, but I've told you that before.
He is her brother. I suppose it is natural.
Natural? Is that what you call it?
My lady, I know you would like it to be a crime to be a fond brother and a cold husband, but there is no statute that makes it so, and no precedent for your relief.
He hesitates.
Do not think I am without sympathy for you.
For what can a woman like Jane Rochford do when circumstances are against her?
A widow well provided can cut a figure in the world. A merchant's wife can, with diligence and prudence, take business matters into her hands and squirrel away a store of gold. A labouring woman ill-used by a husband can enlist robust friends, who will stand outside her house all night and bang pans, till the unshaven churl tips out in his shirt to chase them off, and they pull up his shirt and mock his member. But a young married gentlewoman has no way to help herself. She has no more power than a donkey. All she can hope for is a master who spares the whip.
You know, he says, that your father, Lord Morley, is a scholar I hold in great esteem. Have you never advised with him?
What is the use? She is scornful. When we married, he said he was doing his best for me. It is what fathers say. He paid less mind to contracting me to Boleyn than he would to selling a hound puppy. If you think there's a warm kennel and a dish of broken meats, what more do you need to know? You don't ask the animal what it wants.
So you have never thought you might be released from your marriage?
No, Master Cromwell. My father went into everything thoroughly, just as thoroughly as you would expect of a friend of yours. No previous promise, no pre-contract, no shadow of one. Even you and Cranmer between you couldn't get us an annulment. On the wedding day we sat at our supper with our friends, and George told me, I am only doing this because my father says I must. That was good hearing, you would agree, for a girl of 20 who cherished hopes of love. And I defied him. I said the same back to him. I said, if my father did not enforce me, I would be far from you, sir. So then the light faded, and we were put to bed. He put his hand out and flipped my breast and said, I have seen plenty of these and many better. He said, lie down, open your body, let us do our duty and make my father a grandfather, and then if we have a son we can live apart. I said to him, then do it if you think you can. Pray God you may set seed tonight, and then you may take your dibber away, and I need not look at it again.
A little laugh.
But I am barren, you see, or so I must believe. It may be that my husband's seed is bad or weak. God knows he spends it in some dubious places. Oh, he is a gospeler, is George. St. Matthew be his guide, and St. Luke protect him. No man as godly as George. The only fault he finds with God is that he made folk with too few orifices. If George could meet a woman with a quinny under her armpit, he would call out, Glory be, and set her up in a house and visit her every day until the novelty wore off. Nothing is forbidden to George, you see. He'd go to it with a terrier bitch if she wagged her tail at him and said, Bow wow.
For once he is struck silent. He knows he will never get it out of his mind, the picture of George in a hairy grapple with a little ratting dog.
She says, I am afraid he has given me a disease, and that is why I have never conceived a child. I think there is something destroying me from the inside. I think I might die of it one day.
She had asked him once, if I die suddenly, have them cut open my corpse to look inside. In those days she thought Rochford might poison her. Now she is sure he has done so. He murmurs, My lady, you have borne a great deal. He looks up.
But this is not to the point. If George knows something about the Queen that the King should be told, I can bring him to witness, but I cannot know he will speak out. I can hardly compel the brother against the sister.
She says, I am not talking about his being a witness. I am telling you he spends time in her chamber, alone with her, and the door closed.
In conversation.
I have been to the door and heard no voices.
Perhaps, he says, they join in silent prayer.
I have seen them kiss.
A brother may kiss his sister.
He may not. Not in that way.
He picks up his pen. Lady Rochford, I cannot write down, he kissed her in that way.
His tongue in her mouth, and her tongue in his.
You want me to record that?
If you fear you won't remember it.
He thinks, if this comes out in a law court, the city will be in an uproar. If it is mentioned in Parliament, the bishops will be frigging themselves on their benches. He waits, his pen poised. Why would she do this? Such a crime against nature.
The better to rule. Surely you see it. She is lucky with Elizabeth. The child is like her. But suppose she gets a boy and it has Weston's long face, or it looks like Will Brereton. What might the king say to that? But they cannot call it a bastard if it looks like a Boleyn.
Brereton, too. He makes a note. He remembers how Brereton once joked with him he could be in two places at once. A chilly joke, a hostile joke, and now, he thinks, now at last, I laugh. Lady Rochford says,
Why do you smile?
I have heard that in the Queen's rooms, among her lovers, there was talk of the King's death. Did George ever join in with it?
It would kill Henry if he knew how they laugh at him, how his member is discussed.
I want you to think hard, he says. Be sure of what you are doing. If you give evidence against your husband in a court of law or to the council, you may find yourself a lonely woman in the years to come. Her face says, Am I now so rich in friends?
I will not bear the blame, she says. You will, Master Secretary. I am thought a woman of no great wit or penetration, and you are what you are, a man of resource who spares no one. It will be thought that you drew the truth out of me, whether I was willing or no.
It seems to him little more need be said. In order to sustain that notion, it will be necessary for you to contain your pleasure and feign distress. Once George is arrested, you must petition for mercy for him.
I can do that.
Jane Rochford puts out the tip of her tongue, as if the moment were sugared and she can taste it.
I am safe, for the king will take no notice, I can guarantee.
Be advised by me. Talk to no one.
Be advised by me. Talk to Mark Smeaton.
He tells her, I am going to my house at Stepney. I have asked Mark for supper.
Why not entertain him here?
There has been disturbance enough, don't you think?
Disturbance? Oh, I see,
she says. He watches her out. The door does not close before Rafe and Call Me Risley are in the room with him. Pale and set, both of them steady, from which he knows they have not been eavesdropping.
The king wishes inquiries to begin,
Risley says.
Utmost discretion, but all possible speed. He can no longer ignore the talk after the incident, the quarrel. He has not approached Norris.
No, Rafe says. They think, the gentleman in the privy chamber, that it has all blown over. The queen has calmed herself, by all accounts. Tomorrow's jousts are to go ahead as usual.
I wonder, he says. Would you go to Richard Sampson, Rafe, and tell him that, entre nous, matters are out of our hands? It may not be necessary to sue for nullity after all. Or at least I think the Queen will be disposed to give way to anything the King requires of her. She has not much of a negotiating position left. I think we have Henry Norris within bowshot. Weston. Oh, and Brereton, too.
Rafe Sadler raises his eyebrows.
I would have said the Queen hardly knew him.
It seems he has the habit of walking in at the wrong moment.
You seem very calm, sir, Callme says.
Yes. Learn from it.
What does Lady Rochford say?
He frowns. Rafe, before you go to Sampson, do you sit down there, at the head of the table. Pretend you are the King's Council meeting in privy session.
All of them, sir?
Norfolk and Fitzwilliam and all. Now, call me. You are a lady of the Queen's bedchamber. On your feet. May we have a curtsy?
Thank you.
Now, I am a page who fetches you a stool and a cushion on it. Sit down and give the councillors a smile.
If you will, Rafe says uncertainly.
But then the spirit of the thing seizes him. He reaches forward and tickles Colmy under the chin.
"What have you to tell us, delicate madam? Pray divulge and part your ruby lips."
"This beautiful lady alleges," he says, he, Cromwell, with a wave of his hand, "that the queen is of light conditions, that her conduct gives rise to suspicion of evil-doing, of flouting of the laws of God, even if no one has witnessed actions contrary to statute." Rafe clears his throat.
"Some might say, madam, why did you not speak of this before?"
"Because it was treason to speak against the queen." Mr. Risley is a ready man, and maidenly excuses flow from him. "We had no choice but to shield her. What could we do but reason with her and persuade her to give up her light ways? And yet we could not. She kept us in awe. She is jealous of anyone who has an admirer. She wants to take him from her. She does not scruple to threaten anyone she thinks has erred, whether matron or maid, and she can ruin a woman that way. Look at Elizabeth Worcester."
"So now you can no longer forbear to speak out," Rafe says. "Now burst into tears, Risley," he instructs.
"Consider it done."
Colmy dabs his cheek. "What a play it makes," he sighs. "I wish now we could all take off our disguises and go home." He is thinking Sean Maddock, a boatman on the river at Windsor.
"She goes to it with her brother?"
Thurston, his cook.
"They are standing in a line, frigging their members."
He remembers what Thomas Wyatt told him. "That is Anne's tactic. She says yes, 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 then she says no. The worst of it is her hinting to me, her boasting almost, that she says no to me, but yes to others." He had asked Wyatt, "How many lovers do you think she has had?" And Wyatt had answered, "A dozen? Or none? Or 100? He himself thought Anne cold, a woman who took her maidenhead to market and sold it for the best price. But this coldness, that was before she was wed, before Henry heaved himself on top of her and off again, and she was left, after he had stumbled back to his own apartments, with the bobbing circles of candlelight on the ceiling, the murmurs of her women, the basin of warm water and the cloth, and Lady Rochford's voice as she scrubs herself.
Careful, madam, do not wash away a Prince of Wales.
Soon she is alone in the dark, with a scent of masculine sweat on the linen, and perhaps one useless maidservant turning and snuffling on a pallet. She is alone with the small sounds of river and palace, and she speaks, and no one answers, except the girl who mutters in her sleep. She prays, and no one answers, and she rolls onto her side and smooths her hands over her thighs and touches her own breasts. So what if, one day, it's yes, 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 to whoever happens to be standing by when the thread of her virtue snaps, even if it's her brother? He says to Rafe, to call me, "I have heard such matter today as I never thought to hear in a Christian country." They wait. The young gentleman, their eyes on his face, call me says, "Am I still a lady, or shall I take my seat and pick up my pen?" He thinks, what we do here in England, we send our children into other households when they are young, and so it is not rare for a brother and sister to meet when they are grown, as if for the first time. Think how it must be, then. This fascinating stranger whom you know, this mirror of you. You fall in love, just a little, for an hour, an afternoon, and then you make a joke of it. The residual drag of tenderness remains. It is a feeling that civilizes men and makes them behave better to dependent women than otherwise they might. But to go further, to trespass on forbidden flesh, to leap the great gap from a fleeting thought to action. Priests tell you that temptation slides into sin, and you cannot put a hair between. But surely that is not true. You kiss the woman's cheek? Very well. Then you bite her neck? You say, "Sweet sister." And then next minute you flip her back and cant her skirts up? Surely not. There is a room to be crossed and buttons to be undone. You don't sleepwalk into it. You don't fornicate inadvertently. You don't fail to see the other party, who she is. She doesn't hide her face. But then, it may be that Jane Rochford is lying, She has cause.
I am not often perplexed, he says, about how to proceed, but I find I have to deal with a matter I hardly dare speak of. I can only partly describe it, so I do not know how to draw up a charge sheet. I feel like one of those men who shows a freak at a fair. At a fair, the drunken churls throw down their money, and then they disdain what you offer. Call that a freak? That's nothing to my wife's mother. And all their fellows slap them on the back and chortle. But then you say to them, well, neighbours, I showed you that only to test your mettle. Part with a penny more, and I shall show you what I have here in the back of the tent. It is a sight to make hardened men quail, and I guarantee that you have never seen devil's work like it. And then they look, and then they throw up on their boots, and then you count the money, and lock it in your strongbox. Mark at Stepney.
He has brought his instrument, Richard says, his lute. Tell him to leave it without.
If Mark was blithe before, he is suspicious now, tentative, on the threshold.
I thought, sir, I was to entertain you.
Make no doubt of it.
I had thought there would be a great company, sir.
You know my nephew, Master Richard Cromwell?
Still, I am happy to play for you. Perhaps you want me to hear your singing children?
Not today. In the circumstances, you might be tempted to overpraise them. But will you sit down and take a cup of wine with us?
It would be a charity if he could put us in the way of a rebeck player, Richard says. We have but the one, and he is always running off to Farnham to see his family.
Poor boy, he says, in Flemish. I think he is homesick.
Mark looks up.
I did not know you spoke my language.
I know you did not, or you would not have used it to be so disrespectful of me.
I am sure, sir, I never meant any harm.
Mark can't remember what he's said or not said about his host, but his face shows he recalls the general tenor of it.
You forecast I should be hanged, he spreads his arms. Yet I live and breathe, but I am in a difficulty, and although you do not like me, I have no choice but to come to you. So I ask your charity.
Mark sits, his lips slightly parted, his back rigid, and one foot pointing to the door, showing he would very much like to be out of it.
You see,
he puts his palms together, as if Mark were a saint on a plinth.
My master the king and my mistress the queen are at odds.
Everybody knows it. Now, my dearest wish is to reconcile them, for the comfort of the whole realm. Give the boy this, he is not without spirit.
But, Master Secretary, the word about the court is you are keeping company with the Queen's enemies.
For the better to find out their practices, he says.
If I could believe that.
He sees Richard shift on his stool, impatient.
These are bitter days, he says. I do not remember such a time of tension and misery, not since the Cardinal came down. In truth, I do not blame you, Mark, if you find it hard to trust me. There is such ill feeling at court that no one trusts anyone else. But I come to you because you are close to the Queen, and the other gentlemen will not help me. I have the power to reward you, and will make sure you have everything you deserve, if only you can give me some window into the Queen's desires. I need to know why she is so unhappy, and what I can do to remedy it, for it is unlikely she will conceive an heir while her mind is unquiet. And if she could do that, then all our tears would be dried.
Mark looks up.
Why, it is no wonder she is unhappy, he says. She is in love.
With whom?
With me.
He, Cromwell, leans forward, elbows on the table, then puts a hand up to cover his face.
You are amazed, Mark suggests.
That is only part of what he feels. I thought, he says to himself, that this would be difficult. But it is like picking flowers. He lowers his hand and beams at the boy.
Not so amazed as you might think.
For I have watched you, and I have seen her gestures, her eloquent looks, her many indications of favour. And if these are shown in public, then what in private? And of course it is no surprise any woman will be drawn to you. You are a very handsome young man.
Though we thought you were a sodomite, Richard says.
Not I, sir. Mark turns pink. I am as good a man as any of them.
So the Queen would give a good account of you? He asks, smiling. She has tried you and found you to her liking. The boy's glance slides away, like a piece of silk over glass.
I cannot discuss it.
Of course not. But we must draw our own conclusions. She is not an inexperienced woman, I think. She would not be interested in a less than masterly performance.
We poor men, Mark says, poor men born are in no wise inferior in that way.
True, he says. Though gentlemen keep that fact from ladies if they can.
Otherwise, Richard says, every duchess will be frolicking in a copse with a woodcutter.
He cannot help laugh. Only there are so few duchesses and so many woodcutters. There must be competition between them, you would think. Mark looks at him as if he is profaning a sacred mystery.
If you mean she has other lovers, I have never asked her. I would not ask her. But I know they are jealous of me.
Perhaps she has tried them and found them a disappointment, Richard says. And Mark here takes the prize. I congratulate you, Mark.
With what open, Cromwellian simplicity he leans forward and asks,
How often?
It cannot be easy to steal the opportunity, he suggests, even though her ladies are complicit.
They are not my friends either, Mark says. They would even deny what I have told you. They are friends of Weston, Norris. I am nothing to them. They ruffle my hair and call me waiting boy.
The Queen is your only friend, he says. But such a friend. He pauses.
At some point, it will be necessary for you to say who the others are. You have given us two names.
Mark looks up, shocked at the change of tone. Now name them all, and answer Master Richard. How often? The boy has frozen under his gaze, but at least he enjoyed his moment in the sun. At least he can say he took Master Secretary by surprise, which few men can say who are now living. He waits for Mark.
Well, perhaps you are right not to speak. Best to get it down in writing, no?
I must say, Mark, my clerks will be as astonished as I am. Their fingers will tremble and they will blot the page. So will the council be astonished when they hear of your successes? There will be many lords who envy you. You cannot expect their sympathy. Smeaton, what is your secret? They will demand. You will blush and say, Ah, gentlemen, I cannot impart. But you will impart all, Mark, for they will make you, and you will do it freely or do it enforced. He turns away from the boy as Mark's face falls open in dismay as his body begins to shake. 5 rash minutes of boasting in one ungratified life, and, like nervous tradesmen, the gods at once send in their account. Mark has lived in a story of his own devising, with a beautiful princess in her tower, hears beyond her casement music of unearthly sweetness. She looks out, and sees by moonlight the humble musician with his lute. But unless the musician turns out to be a prince in disguise, this story cannot end well. The doors open and ordinary faces crowd in. The surface of the dream is shattered. You are in Stepney, on a warm night at the beginning of spring. The last birdsong is fading into the hush of twilight. Somewhere a bolt rattles, a stool is scraped across the floor. A dog barks below the window, and Thomas Cromwell says to you,
We all want our supper. Let's get on. Here is the paper and the ink. Here is Master Risley. He will write for us.
I can give no names, the boy says.
You mean the Queen has no lovers but you?
So she tells you. But I think, Mark, she has been deceiving you.
Which she could easily do, you must admit, if she has been deceiving the King.
No, the poor boy shakes his head. I think she is chaste. I do not know how I came to say what I said.
Nor do I. No one had hurt you, had they? Or coerced you, or tricked you? You spoke freely. Master Richard is my witness.
I take it back.
I don't think so. There is a pause, while the room repositions itself. Figures dispose themselves in the landscape of the evening. Master Secretary says, It's chilly. We should have a fire lit. Just an ordinary household request, and yet Mark thinks they mean to burn him. He jumps off his stool and makes for the door, perhaps the first bit of sense he's shown, but Christoph is there, broad and amiable to head him off.
Seat yourself, pretty boy,
Christoph says. The wood is laid already. Such a long time it takes to fan the spark. A little welcome crackle, and the servant withdraws, wiping his hands on his apron. And Mark watches the door close after him, with a lost expression that may be envy, because he would rather be a kitchen hand now, or a boy that scours privy pits. Oh, Mark, Master Secretary says, ambition is a sin, so I am told. Though I have never seen how it is different from using your talents, which the Bible commands we do. So here you are, and here I am, and both of us servants of the Cardinal at one time. And if he could see us here tonight, do you know, I don't think he would be the least surprised. Now, to business. Who did you displace in the Queen's bed? Was it Norris? Or perhaps you have a rota like the Queen's chamber servants?
I don't know. I take it back. I can give you no names.
It is a shame you should suffer alone, if others are culpable. And of course they are more culpable than you, as they are gentlemen whom the King has personally rewarded and made great, and all of them educated men, and some of them of mature years, whereas you are simple and young, and as much to be pitied as punished, I would say. Tell us now about your adultery with the Queen and what you know of her dealings with other men, and then if your confession is prompt and full, clear and unsparing, it is possible that the King will show mercy. Mark is hardly hearing him. His limbs are trembling and his breathing is short. He is beginning to cry and to stumble over his words. Simplicity is best now. Brisk questions requiring easy answers. Richard asks him, You see this person here? Christoph points to himself in case Mark is in doubt.
Do you take him for a pleasant fellow? Richard asks. Would you like to spend 10 minutes alone with him?
5 would do it, Christoph predicts.
He says, I explained to you, Mark, that Mr. Risley will write down what we say. But he will not necessarily write down what we do. You follow me? That will be just between us. Mark says,
Mother Mary, help me.
Mr. Risley says, We can take you to the tower where there is a rack. Risley, may I have a word with you aside? He waves call me out of the room and on the threshold speaks in an undertone. It is better not to specify the nature of the pain. As Juvenal says, the mind is its own best torturer. Besides, you should not make empty threats. I will not rack him. I do not want him carried to his trial in a chair. And if I needed to rack a sad little fellow like this, what next? Stamping on dormice?
I am reproved,
Mr. Risley says. He puts his hand on Risley's arm. Never mind. You are doing very well. This is a business that tries the most experienced. He remembers that day in the forge when a hot iron had seared his skin. There was no choice of resisting the pain. His mouth dropped open and a scream flew out and hit the wall. His father ran to him and said, Cross your hands, and helped him to water and to salve. But afterwards Walter said to him, It's happened to us all, it's how you learn. You learn to do things the way your father taught you and not by some foolish method you hit upon yourself 30 minutes ago. He thinks of this. Re-entering the room, he asks Mark, Do you know you can learn from pain? But, he explains, the circumstances must be right. To learn, you must have a future.
What if someone has chosen this pain for you, and they are going to inflict it for as long as they like, and only stop once you're dead? You can make sense of your suffering, perhaps. You can offer it up for the struggling souls in purgatory, if you believe in purgatory. That might work for saints whose souls are shining white, but not for Mark Smeaton, who is in mortal sin, a self-confessed adulterer. He says, "No one wants your pain, Mark. It's no good to anyone. No one's interested in it, not even God himself, and certainly not me. I have no use for your screams. I want words that make sense, words I can transcribe. You have already spoken them, and it will be easy enough to speak them again. So now what you do is your choice. It is your responsibility. You have done enough, by your own account, to damn you. Do not make sinners of us all." It may even now be necessary to impress on the boy's imagination the stages on the route ahead, the walk from the room of confinement to the place of suffering, the weight as the rope is uncoiled or the guiltless iron is set to heat. In that space, every thought that occupies the mind is taken out and replaced by blind terror. Your body is emptied and filled up with dread. The feet stumble, the breath labours. The eyes and ears function, but the head can't make sense of what is seen and heard. Time falsifies itself, moments becoming days. The faces of your torturers loom up like giants, or they become impossibly distant, small, like dots. Words are spoken. "Bring him here. Seat him. Now it is time." They were words attached to other and common meanings, but if you survive this, they will only ever have one meaning, and the meaning is pain. The iron hisses as it is lifted from the flame. The rope doubles like a serpent, loops itself and waits. It is too late for you. You will not speak now because your tongue has swelled and filled your mouth and language has eaten itself. Later you will speak, when you are carried away from the machinery and set down on straw. "I have endured it," you will say. "I have come through." And pity and self-love will crack open your heart so that at the first gesture of kindness, let us say a blanket or a sip of wine, your heart will overflow, your tongue unstop. Out flow the words. You were not brought to this room to think, but to feel, and in the end you have felt too much for yourself. But Mark will be spared this, for now he looks up.
"Master Secretary, will you tell me again what my confession must be? Clear and, what was it? There were four things, but I have already forgot them."
In a thicket of words he is stuck fast, and the more he fights, the deeper the thorns rip his flesh. If appropriate, a translation can be made for him, yet his English has always seemed good enough.
"But you understand me, sir. I cannot tell you what I do not know."
"Can you not? Then you must be my guest tonight. Christoph, you can see to that, I think. In the morning, Mark, your own powers will surprise you. Your head will be clear and your memory perfect. You will see that it is not in your interests to protect the gentlemen who share your sin, because if the position were reversed, believe me, they would not spare a thought for you."
This ends Disc 8.